most faces, so I maybe don't need to reintroduce myself. I'm Marion Sullivan. I've been in Boston. I'm a doctor. And this is the fifth of our five sessions on the relationship between healthcare and religion and that conversation. So just to recap themes from the week, we started by thinking about this tension between finite resources needing infinite needs, and the way in which our focus on technology and medical care has distracted us from other investments in important determinants of health, schools, parks, neighborhoods, churches. We talked both on Wednesday and in the evening yesterday about the way in which the logic of the healthcare marketplace has created unjust inequalities in well-being and has also shaped and, I would say, distorted our thinking about what's possible in creating and sustaining health. We also talked about the Affordable Care Act. Here I say I think it's a brave and pragmatic attempt at working within the boundaries of the existing healthcare marketplace to reduce inequities and also to provoke the healthcare delivery system to try to behave in more patient-centered ways. And then yesterday we were focused on death and dying, and I summarized that theme here by saying that thinking about death and dying provides a special opportunity to consider what it means to be human from these two different perspectives, the perspective of the dominant paradigm within the U.S. healthcare system and the perspective that we get from our Christian tradition. And I gave us this frame that I think our Christian tradition invites us to remember that we are incarnated, finite human beings, and also that we are oriented towards the infinite, and that as we progress through our lives, our finite human bodies get weaker and more frail, but our spiritual orientation towards the infinite actually continues to open over the course of time. And I encouraged us to think about that frame as a way to think about so today, we're going to move into thinking about a sort of constructive, creative way of moving forward. I'm leaving the village tomorrow. I don't know if others of you are as well. But I think this is an opportunity to think about what we might take away from Golden Village. So the World Health Organization defines health as a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmities. Not dramatically different than what we have been talking about over the course of this week. I think that in our religious frame, we might broaden that even a little bit further. And I introduce here this concept of shalom. Here's a definition from theologian named Cornelius Plantinga. Shalom is the webbing together of God, humans, and all creation in justice, fulfillment, and light. It's what the Hebrew prophets call shalom. We call it peace, but it means far more than mere peace of mind or a ceasefire between enemies. In the Bible, shalom means universal flourishing, wholeness, and delight, a rich state of affairs in which natural needs are satisfied, and natural gifts fruitfully employed, a state of affairs that inspires joyful wonder as its creator and savior opens doors and welcomes the creatures in whom he delights. Shalom, in other words, is the way things ought to be. So an even broader notion of health. So there is a Methodist pastor who's also a family physician who has created a clinic that he calls the Church Health Center in Memphis, Tennessee. And he wrote a book, it's probably written a couple, but he wrote a book about his Church Health Center. And this is the frame that he uses for thinking about the delivery of healthcare services in a holistic and spiritual frame. So he has your life in the center, and then he has all these different domains that need to come together in order to create wholeness or well-being in your life. And it's not dramatically surprising, but it's nice, I think, the way that he sort of put it together into a picture. So there's nutrition, friends and family, faith life, movement, medical needs, work, and emotional needs. And we're going to work our way through this little diagram, and then I'm ultimately going to ask you to do your own sort of personal self-help assessment using his frame. So, nutrition. How should we eat if we want to be well? Real food. Okay.
Tonight's dinner is pretty good. Pretty close, really.
What about tonight's dinner? I would agree. What about tonight's dinner was a good way to eat?
Well, it's whole grain rolls and salmon and lots of really wonderful colored vegetables.
Locally grown, organic,
fresh fruits and vegetables, whole foods. Anything else about the meal that we ate tonight?
The community of eating slowly.
We didn't eat alone. We ate together. We ate in community. We said grace before we ate. We were grateful. We recognized this as a gift. Water was on the table. Water.
We lingered also. We ate. Uh-huh. It wasn't an easy job.
Slow food. And enjoying conversation with one another around the table. When I discharge patients from the hospital, I have a little form that the electronic medical record asks me to complete, and then it spits out some papers that go to the patient. And there's a little form that says diet, and I can choose regular, diabetic, low fat, low salt, renal, something like that. And in the context of all of this reading that I've been doing for this session, I've started, there's a little free text place at the bottom, and I've started to type in things like, eat a meal with people you love. Just for the heck of it. Because I can.
Does the computer blow up?
Surprisingly, it doesn't. I think those are all the right answers in terms of how we should be eating. This gentleman, Scott Morris, makes the point in his book that mealtime should be relational, and he makes the point that Jesus used meals to create community. He ate in the homes of all sorts of people. He fed crowds. He ate with his friends. He made breakfast for his friends after he was resurrected. And then that food is a gift from God, right? from Genesis. I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit will see it. So friends and family, what should we do to cultivate health and wholeness with respect to our friends and family?
Spend time together.
Emphasizes that we are created to need one another. In the very beginning, the Lord God said, it is not good that man should be alone. And he also makes the point that if we invest in cultivating relationships before we have desperate need, then when we do have desperate need, we have people that we can turn to. It's very easy to ignore the importance of cultivating friends and family when you feel strong and independent and capable. And so the investments that we make along the way really make a difference when we are actually in a position to meet people. And this is one of those things that it's never too late to make a difference. So what matters in terms of cultivating a healthy emotional life?
Making time for yourself. Seeking help when you need it.
seeking help when you need it.
Cultivating laughter and joy.
Cultivating laughter and joy.
Doing each season of life's work, like different tasks or different seasons of life, doing work.
Say more about that.
Most of it's about letting go. Most of it's about letting go, as someone mentioned, living in the moment and seeing the way I frame myself. What gift is God giving me in this season? What gifts are God? Is God offering me now, not before, not down the road, but what are the gifts God's offering me right now? That and letting go of seem to be not taking this.
The flip side of that, of course, is embracing what is now.
Judgment, they underlie the decisions we make. It's hard to underestimate the power of emotions in shaping our life and our behavior. We also argue that we should be taking out our emotional trash on a regular basis. That we have, our lives are full of stress and anxiety and worry, and we carry those things, and we don't empty it. I think certainly my experience in caring for patients who are sick is that there's an overwhelming amount of depression in our culture, and there's an overwhelming amount of despair. And I feel as though I see people come into the healthcare system really just in a state of despair about what might be possible for them. They can hardly even imagine something good.
Can you speculate on the reasons for that?
To me, it looks like loneliness. I just think we have the loneliest culture in the world. Mm-hmm. I see so many people who have no one and who haven't been able to cultivate relationships over time because of their own emotional immaturity, lack of capacity for forgiveness, for communication. So I feel the weight of a lot of despair. And part of cultivating emotional health is actually finding sources of hope and things to believe in, things to actually things to encourage.
Turning off the TV is a good start. Mm-hmm.
That's so serious. What matters in work? So work can be a source of joy.
Work-life balance.
Yeah, so work is critical, but it's not the whole enchilada, right? It's when I do my own personal self-health assessment with Dr. Morris's model, I can see, wow, I spend way too much time working. And I have underinvested in my family and friends relative to the amount I've invested in my work and my sense of identity at work. Things I'm adding to my professional life. So work can definitely get too big in our lives.
You look for meaning in your work. Doing for others.
Yeah, so having work that connects you to something that feels useful, which is has to do with service, I think, who is people.
Doing it with integrity.
To what?
Doing it with integrity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can remember from my high school graduation. I went to a Christian high school in Minneapolis, and my high school graduation speaker spoke on Paul, and the only thing I remember is that he said that Paul was a good tent maker. That was his work. And in order to be a faithful person of integrity, you should do whatever you do with a sense of integrity and purpose and care. Mm-hmm. It totally stuck with me that doing your work with integrity matters. So I think Scott Morris makes the point that work is a gift. And again, he quotes Genesis, so God took the people and put them in the Garden of Eden to till it and to keep it. And then he makes the point that there's all different kinds of relationships people have to their work. For some people, work is a source of joy and meaning, and they love their work, and work is a source of self-expression. For some people, they work just because it's necessary to make ends meet, and work is not a source of self-expression. Some people are desperate to find a job. Some people have retired and no longer have an official role in work. Some people work in the home and don't make money for it, and so that's not valued. But what we do, whether it's paid or not paid, whether it's highly technical or not, whether it's professional or not, what we do, how we actually spend our days, whether it's paid work or not, is an important part of how we are created to be. You know, I care for so many people who are unemployed, who don't do anything all day long. They watch television. They don't get out of their houses because of the overwhelming sense of despair that they live with. It's the nature of your work. If you work in a public hospital, you see people who have been unemployed for years and years and can't imagine working. And it feels to me as though remembering the critical gift of work is so think about movement.
I'm just saying. I feel better after I have gone to the gym. I come up here to Holden. It's the only place that I run.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel better afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it happens on a regular basis, whatever form.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, our bodies are created to move. Is about a whole lot more than just losing weight. It improves your mood and promotes sleep and boosts your energy and combats disease and makes you feel better about yourself. Just moving. It doesn't have to be 30 minutes of exercise 3 times a day at the target heart rate. Just moving. And it's possible for all of us to move more than we do now. However amount we're moving, we could be moving more. And there's all sorts of research that suggests that standing is better than sitting. So even if we sit at desks, we could stand. It uses more of our body, it engages more of our muscles.
It's also better for your bones.
Yeah.
My doctor said that I should sit the very most 4 hours a day. Mm-hmm. That's it. Mm-hmm. And she has me on odometers. I don't know how many. Minimum 10,000 steps.
All right, and medical care. So in this kind of a portrait of the things that create health, medical care, as you see, has a relatively small piece of the pie. If everybody was eating well and working meaningfully and moving regularly and connected to friends and family and managing their stress in a healthy way, it would be a relatively small amount of work for the medical care system to do. What's important in medical care slice of this pie?
I think it is to have a doctor that you trust, that you can talk to, ask questions of, and have answers, that there's communication. I think that's the primary care physician.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's nice to have the specialist, but you need someone
Yep.
That you can really communicate with.
Yeah, so cultivating a partnership is critical.
Yes.
And recognizing that that's a two-way partnership. You bring something to it. If you're in a relationship with a doctor that you can't trust or you can't communicate with or you can't understand,
right.
I think that's a two-way street too. The physician communicating that he does care.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been lucky in my life to have some people that they put me down and they really do care. They say, Tom, you're going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
I think also, which I think doctors are trying to do, be more proactive. It's hard in that situation to have such a little bit of time and to be proactive.
Mm-hmm.
We value that.
There's certainly a portion of it that's self-awareness too. What does my body do? What does it mean? When is it off? When do I need to see someone else? Or when do I need to change things? So that self-awareness.
Yeah, that's huge. So I think the more we as individuals can own our own well-being, we can be much wiser users of the healthcare system. Talking over the course of the week about how much money we spend in the United States on our healthcare system, and interestingly, every single time we try to do experiments in which we engage patients more fully in decision making, we really take the time to explain the pros and cons of this versus that, this test and this drug. Inevitably, patients choose less intervention, and they spend less money on their healthcare. And so, being a well-informed, active participant in this relationship with the healthcare system is just fundamental. But there's so much about the culture of the medical care system that actually sort of paternalistic and doesn't. The tradition within the medical care establishment is not one that actually engages patients as full partners. And so right now, that's a counterculture movement, and you have to bring your own advocacy into that relationship to make sure that you are treated as a full person. Many, many people that I care for don't ask me questions. And they, I have learned to, if I ask somebody, do you have any questions, they will generally say no. That's not enough to actually truly invite a question. So I'll explain something, and then I have to say, so tell me how you're going to tell your husband about that, so that I know what they've heard. And when I do that, I find out, oh, wow, they really didn't understand anything I said.
Yeah.
I thought it was so clear, and I drew pictures. And so I think it's very, very easy to assume a passive role as a patient and just accept that, oh, I'm not going to understand what the doctor says. I never understand what doctors say. And so not settling for that is I think, really, really important. So Dr. Morris says, the things that we've been saying, basically, launch a partnership, give and expect respect. And the clearer we can be about our own values, as we were talking about the end-of-life care yesterday, the clearer we can be about what abundant life we're seeking, what is health for us, what really matters, the clearer we can be about our own understanding of an abundant life, the clearer we can be in engaging the healthcare system as a partner in that. Don't let the healthcare system tell you what an abundant life looks like. You need to know what an abundant life looks like for you, and then engage the healthcare system as a partner. The healthcare system has so much power that it sometimes defines the abundant life for patients and families who are not confident enough to define it for themselves.
Is it all right to see ourselves, or is it appropriate to see ourselves as consumers of medical care in that respect?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that there are lots of metaphors that work for understanding the patient-doctor relationship or the patient-healthcare provider relationship, patient-healthcare system relationship. The consumer is one metaphor. What are the advantages of that metaphor?
You can pick and choose. You can make the best deal.
Yeah. So it's a, the customer is always right, right? The customer is always right. So the customer that, you know, you work for your customers. And so the customer is coming with the resources and your preferences matter. And so in that way, the consumer metaphor is a helpful one in empowering patients to engage the healthcare system. What are some of the downsides of that metaphor?
Customer service is sometimes wrong. particularly if they've, you know, we've talked a little bit before about the, you know, the advertising, things like that. If you come in saying, well, the ad told me I should come in and get this medication, and it turns out that's really not an appropriate medication, a person does that physician feel that strength enough in their own conviction to say, no, that's not actually appropriate for you, let's talk about this other thing, instead of just succumbing to, okay, you really want it, I guess you're having med, even mm-hmm. though you know it's really not going to be really good for them. Mm-hmm. Or they actually damage them.
Yeah. So if you're buying boots at L.L. Bean, you can do the research online and you can make a decision. The person who's selling them to you may know a little bit more about boots than you do, but probably didn't go to school for 15 years to learn boots. And so there's a little bit more rest. There's the relationship doesn't have the same sort of information power differential that you have in a doctor-patient relationship. So that's a limit, I think, of it.
I think you also lose the partnership relationship. It's more of a give and give. If I'm a consumer,
when we talk a little about the care, medical care, harder as a consumer to expect care on either part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's usually not just a simple business transaction because you're more vulnerable than you are in an average business transaction, and so there is a, it's a relationship that you hope has more of a covenantal quality to it. That there's actually compassion that is at the core of that relationship. And in a consumer transaction, you don't get that. But I think probably it's the case that not every time a patient encounters the healthcare system is the same. So sometimes, you know, if you have a urinary tract infection and you just need antibiotics, you can have a pretty simple consumer encounter with basically an antibiotic salesperson in some ways. If you have a life-threatening illness and you're trying to make very complicated medical decisions over time, then you need more than just a consumer relationship with a salesperson.
I suppose I was thinking that at least that's not entirely on the side. I guess I was thinking about I had more different aspects of consumerism, but if you play a part in choosing, then you're empowered in some way.
Yep.
You know, whereas if you're not, you're not as empowered, and maybe not as likely to get well.
Yep. And I think in that way, the consumer metaphor is a step forward from some of the ways in which the traditional sick role is one in which the patient has no decision-making capacity, is a completely passive lump on which healing is worked. And so consumerism is a step in the right direction in terms of that kind of
thing. One of the other interesting things about the consumer model of U.S. healthcare because of insurance is that seldom do any patients understand, and maybe almost as seldom does the physician understand, what is the value of the transaction.
Mm-hmm. Financial aid.
Mm-hmm. No, when I do this boot thing with L.L. Bean and I find one and I say, I'm going to compare, does Walmart carry these boots? Okay. And I understand the financial value of the transaction and both parties do. But my guess is that you have transactions where you don't know any more about the financial value of it than your patient does.
Absolutely. That's a huge, huge issue. And ultimately, the way that we do our financing in healthcare doesn't make it we don't do it in a way that's useful for decision making.
Uh-huh.
So
oh,
what you would want, and there's a guy named Michael Porter at the Harvard Business School who's written about value in healthcare, and he talks about the need to have a value frame where it would be possible for you to say, for example, I'd like to have my hip replaced. And I'd like to think about that as a whole episode. So that means the going in to make the decision to have it done, so the first visit with the orthopedic surgeon, the hospital, the pre-hospital physical therapy, the hospital, the rehab, the follow-up visit with my primary care physician, the 6 months worth of physical therapy in order to get back to where I was before. I'd like to know what that whole package costs, so that I could either choose to buy it or not. And I'd like to choose to buy it from this system, or I'd like to choose to buy it from this system. But all the pieces are so fragmented that there's no place that the consumer can say, yeah, I'd like to buy this.
I wouldn't take my car in and have the engine rebuilt and say, well, let's start and let's have a little consultation. That'll be $50. Well, now let's go in and pull ahead. And, oh, that's $150. Oh, you want a new head gasket. Oh,
yeah.
Well, there's...
So we haven't figured out how to organize our thinking about value in a way that's actually useful to people who are trying to make value-based decisions.
There's another piece here that I don't know where it goes in here. And I guess I'm not elderly yet. I don't know. But as you get on, you need support from your family. But also, I have heard this, and it's not good. Well, that person is pretty old. Do we really want to do something like that? Is it value to you, though? You know, he's 81, and what do you think? Do you put that much effort into it? That's scary. Where they kind of make a decision on age, or that's cut off, we're not going to do it.
Yeah, I think this gets into this notion of abundant life. So not everybody who's 81 is the same. And so and not everybody who's 61 or 41 is the same. And so having a clear understanding of what is an abundant life for you, what is actually going to add value, and then having really good, honest, clear conversations with the healthcare system about what are the risks and benefits of this, and what is the likelihood that this is going to actually improve my quality of life. In order to have those conversations in ways that are actually adding value, everybody needs to be pretty well informed, and everybody needs to invest in that conversation. I think way too often the healthcare system under-informs people, and so they can't actually participate in making meaningful decisions about, is this actually going to add value to me or not? If I have a, if I'm never going to recover to the place that I was before this surgery, is this surgery a good idea for me?
Well, another player that comes in, it's off the top end, but is insurance. But we found in the area of mental health that it depends on what insurance is to what treatment your juvenile would get, or how much, that it's, that's kind of what the plan becomes.
And that's true of cost, too. Some insurance companies and businesses make deals, so people under this plan will pay this much for some service, and under another plan, they'll pay a different amount, and Medicare or Medicaid will pay a different amount. So as a caregiver, I can imagine you have no clue how much it's going to cost somebody, because you don't know what their insurance plan exactly covers for that particular procedure or income. So, yes.
So how about our faith life? What is important in maintaining our health? Goes into this slice of the pie. Time.
Community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oftentimes our faith life is wrapped up in our relationship to our church, and so there's an overlap between our friends and family sector of the pie here and the faith life sector of the pie.
You know, I'm also a healthcare provider. I'm not a physician. And that's a huge problem of physical therapists that I see is that of anxiety. People are so anxious that even when they understand what you want them to do, even when they understand what they need to do, they are so blocked by their anxiety, and it seems like they have a very supportive family, and it seems like they have the necessary things for nutrition and good shelter, things like that, which some of my patients don't. And yet they are so anxious, not necessarily the anxiousness you would associate with real depression, but just so anxious and fearful. And it seems like in the hospital in which I work, it's like it's on every chart. You know, it's one of the top six things. And do you have any thoughts on that, other than, because it's not a good paying code, you know, it's not like people are going to want to code them just because that's an up code for any healthcare plan. If anything, it's a down code. So, so it's, did you know what I'm saying? So it's a real problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a huge issue, and it's, so I think our dominant frame for anxiety would say that that's a mental health problem, and consequently it needs an SSRI, it needs a drug of some sort. I would agree with you that I think a lot of the anxiety that I see is actually not a mental health problem. I think it's a spiritual health problem. I think it's an existential anxiety that actually it's not a major mental illness, and it's not going to go away with a drug. It's actually a different problem, but we don't actually have much of a language for that in healthcare. And many patients who suffer from this problem wouldn't define it as a spiritual problem. That's not their own frame for it either. But I feel like it's a huge crisis, actually. Yeah.
And many times they're not even really aware that they're anxious, they can't even identify that I'm afraid, So I think you're right. I think it's a huge, lack of faith in
profoundly limiting the well-being of our public, of ourselves and our communities and our population.
Are there other cultures that do women health and faith?
Well, I think that historically, there was a much tighter relationship between health and faith. And I think there are pockets of places where people are actively engaging. I think you were talking about Minnesota and some of the work where at Fairview Southdale, where there is a very active between a group of church communities and this hospital. Certainly, in the world that I live in, nobody in the hospital thinks about faith explicitly. We don't even have a chapel.
I heard on National Public Radio they were interviewing these two women that had written a book. And the book was on quality of life and quality of health care. And they did all the study. And they said that Norway and Denmark and Sweden, Finland, were so far above us on satisfaction of life, not necessarily religion, but faith.
Mm-hmm.
And their response to how come, they said that we live in such a society, Americans, that the disparity between the rich and the poor is so vast that it naturally is going to produce all this stress and problems.
Mm-hmm.
And where in Norway and Sweden, the disparity is so much less. And also, they put a lot of emphasis on high taxes, but they have very good education, and they really believe in exercise.
Mm-hmm.
They're not attached to their car.
Dr. Morris makes these points about the relationship between faith and healing. He says that healing is always a mystery. He reminds us that illness and suffering actually can be a way to grow closer to God. I think one of the things that is interesting about spirituality and health is that it's not always clear that that suffering is the good outcome would be a good outcome is not always clear because growth, spiritual growth, may come through difficult situations.
No, this is one thing too that somebody that doesn't have a real faith or suffering trying to hang on, where my mom was saying, it's time to go and God will take care of you and it's just peace, you know, where there's a belief, you know, just going. I don't know if anybody's experienced that, but it just seems that if they know that where they're going, they can be much more relaxed if it's an end of life thing. Mm-hmm. And the same way with this too.
Mm-hmm.
If you believe the doctor says you're going to die in 2005, or like this Frankel's wandering around here, and now it's 2012 and still going.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think to the extent that faith gives people the opportunity to live with a sense that life and death are in God's hands, that helps tremendously. I think the other thing that he points out theologically is that we can have faith that God cares about our suffering and that God will not abandon us. So I'm going to give you maybe 5 minutes to talk to your neighbor, thinking about yourself and your own health, and identifying areas where you feel as though your health is strong, and areas where you would like to prioritize actually improving your own health. It was striking to me when I read his model because I'm a doctor, to think about, well, I'm in good health, I don't take any medicines. But when I actually look at a more holistic model for what it means to be well, I would say, I work too much. I'm out of touch with a lot of friends. I carry a lot of stress and don't talk about it very much. I could move a lot more than I do. And so when I look at this and assess myself, I feel as though I'm not really as healthy as I thought I was. So he encourages people to, so his church health clinic has a, it has a medical care capacity, but they also have a big wellness center and they do a lot of coaching and they really try to help people think broadly about their own well-being, and they try to put people in a position of power to say, this is what I want, this is how I want to live, this is what I want to make happen in my life. And so they encourage people to make very explicit, articulate goals about what it is they're trying to do with their own life. And they encourage people to be to take simple, small steps that are actionable and realistic and time-bound. So if I'm going to make a SMART goal for myself, I could say, I think that we should have friends to dinner every Sunday night for the next 2 months. See if we can do that. Something concrete, something specific, something that we could actually try and we could actually commit to. So I'm going to encourage you to just talk to the person next to you for 5 minutes. Think about yourself and think about one little concrete goal that you could make that actually might improve your own health. One little thing that you might actually do, one small concrete step that might be possible.
At least one.
this model in my mind, is that this makes health into a self-improvement project.
Yeah.
And as Christians, that's not the end of it, right? It's not a self-improvement project for us as Christians. We have this complicated relationship with Jesus. So somehow we believe that our healing is related to Jesus, and that we are healed in some way through his death and suffering, right? Surely he has borne our infirmities and carried our disease, yet we accounted him stricken, struck down by God and afflicted. He was wounded for our transgressions, crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the punishment that made us whole, and by his bruises we are healed. And somehow our healing is related to our service that we give to the world. Is not this the fast that I choose, to loose the bounds of injustice, the bonds of injustice, to undo the thongs of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free, and to break every yoke? Is it not to share your bread with the hungry, to bring the homeless poor into your house, when you see the naked, to cover them, and not to hide yourself from your own kin? Then your light shall break forth like the dawn, and your healing shall spring up quickly. If you remove the yoke from among you, the pointing of the finger, the speaking of evil, if you offer your food to the hungry and satisfy the needs of the afflicted, then your light shall rise in the darkness and your gloom be like the new day. The Lord will guide you continually and satisfy your needs in parched places and make your bones strong, and you shall be like a watered garden, like a spring of water whose waters never fail.
I was just saying that the wholeness wheel that you have you seen the ELCA wholeness wheel?
Does it look like that?
Very similar, but the center, the spokes in the center, or the spokes lead to the center where it's new life in Christ. That's everything. So faith isn't a separate category. It's the center from which everything else comes.
Uh-huh.
And so I kind of connect that with what, the Lord is the one who's going to satisfy your needs.
Mm-hmm.
All of those.
Mm-hmm. So the thing I've been thinking about is that if I add community service to my wheel, it's another place where I might fail. It's another place where I just might actually fall short, because I actually can't make myself whole. I can't do it. That's what we believe as Christians, right? That we are dependent on God. So fundamentally, we are unable to heal ourselves. We remain wounded. And so the WHO definition of health, that's not attainable. We can't do that for ourselves as individuals. We can't do that for society. And I love Henry Nouwen's construct here of the wounded healer, because it offers, I think, another way of thinking about the project. So here's a story from his book. But do you know this construct, the wounded healer? But just the way, even if you've never read the book, it's a book from probably 1965 or something like that. It's an old book. But even if you've never read the book, what does the frame suggest to you? wounded healer, just the name, the words.
Although we don't have to be whole and unblemished in order to be healers.
Yes. And he goes even farther to say, not only do we not need to be perfect in order to be helpful to others, but it's in our woundedness that we are most helpful to others. That's actually where the power lies. That's where Jesus' power comes from, and that's where our power comes from, is our woundedness. So he tells this story. Rabbi Yashua ben Levi came upon Elijah the prophet when he was standing at the entrance of Rabbi Cimarron ben Lohi's cave. He asked Elijah, "When will the Messiah come?" Elijah replied, "Go and ask him yourself. Where is he?" "Sitting at the gates of the city. How shall I know him?" "He is sitting among the poor, covered with wounds. The others unbind all their wounds at the same time and then bind them up again. But he unbinds one at a time, saying to himself, 'Perhaps I shall be needed. If so, I must always be ready so as not to delay for a moment.'" Isaiah is the one who is binding his wounds one at a time so that he can be ready to help. Henry Nouwen says, "Making one's own wounds a source of healing does not call for a sharing of superficial personal pains, but for a constant willingness to see one's own pain and suffering as rising from the depth of the human condition which all people share." How does healing take place? Many words such as care and compassion, understanding and forgiveness, fellowship and community have been used for the healing task of the Christian minister. I like to use the word hospitality. A minister is not a doctor whose primary task is to take away pain. Rather, the minister deepens the pain to a level where it can be shared. When someone comes with his loneliness to the minister, he can only expect that this loneliness will be understood and felt so that he no longer has to run away from it, but can accept it of his own basic human condition. So Henry Nouwen says that what we offer to one another as human beings is solidarity in being human. And the way that we do that is by knowing deeply our own brokenness. And then we can participate in the brokenness of other people. And that is where healing comes from.
He also says in hospitality that that is making a safe place for people to be themselves.
When I think about what makes Holden a healing community, I think it's hospitality. I love that notion. And even has the same root, hospitality. That healing is about hospitality, about making space for the humanness of the other. And so as committed as we are to making ourselves whole in the way that the pie encourages us to do that, fundamentally, that's a flawed project. It's an important project, but the actual energy for our own healing comes from this hospitality that we cultivate in relationship to ourselves and in relationship to other people. So the story, the story ends here. "Peace unto you, my master and teacher." The Messiah answered, "Peace unto you, son of Levi." He asked, "When is the master coming?" "Today," he answered. Rabbi Yashua turned to Elijah, who asked, "What did he tell you?" "He indeed has deceived me, for he said, 'Today I am coming,' and he has not come." Elijah said, "This is what he told you. Today, if you would listen to his voice." I think the story is about, yeah, we actually have everything we need right now to be healers and to actually embrace our own wholeness. We have it right now. It's available to us. So, thank you. It's 7:15. I can certainly stay and we can continue the conversation. conversation. It's been a great grace for me to have the opportunity to pull these thoughts together for myself and to share them with you and to hear your thoughts.